From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I just have to be there to see how ridiculous we can be, some of our fellow citizens can be. I will be watching.
This is a lame duck Congress that is imposing its will on the American people. There'll be five people voting who were defeated by the public on November the 3rd. If the five who were defeated were not voting and the five who won were voting, they would not have the votes. It's the kind of coup d'etat.
Jesse Jackson, Maya Angelou, and thousands of others are expected to rally outside Congress as it decides whether to impeach the president. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Bill Clinton met with his top foreign policy advisors this morning to discuss a report that Iraq is not cooperating with weapons inspectors. The session included Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Secretary of Defense William Cohen, and Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Army General Henry Shelton. U.S. military forces in the Gulf region, including 201 aircraft and 22 warships, are poised for possible strikes against Iraq. The State Department called yesterday's report by Richard Butler, head of the U.N. Special Commission on Iraq, UNSCOM, a very serious matter, and warned that all U.S. options against Iraq remain open. U.N. weapons inspectors evacuated abruptly from Iraq, arrived in Bahrain this morning, and all of the world's body international staff have now left Iraq, according to a U.N. official. State Department spokesperson James Foley said last night the report was very serious. In his report to the U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan and the U.N. Security Council, Richard Butler, head of the U.N. Special Commission, said the Iraq's conduct had impeded progress and disarmament and accounting for prohibited weapons programs. Pentagon spokesperson Ken Bacon stressed that despite the impeachment proceedings against Clinton in connection with his relationship with the former White House aide, the president had full moral responsibility and authority to make any decision on Iraq policy. Meanwhile, the human rights group Voices in the Wilderness has been notified by the Justice Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control that they will be fined more than $160,000 for taking goods like medicine into Iraq in violation of the embargo. Four individuals who participated in those trips have been individually fined, including Dan Handelman from Portland, Oregon.
My first reaction was I was very enthusiastic, because the reason we went on these trips was to violate the sanctions in order to expose the law as unjust. And now here's the government saying, you people have illegally brought medicine and toys to sick and dying children in Iraq. And in my case, they specifically are saying, you brought blank videotape into Iraq, and then you brought exposed videotape back out again, and we're charging you an extra $2,000 for doing that. And I think showing how ridiculous the extent of these sanctions, which have killed nearly if not more than a million people in Iraq.
That is Dan Handelman, one of the members of Voices in the Wilderness. The group says it will reject the government's warning and instead continue to demonstrate against sanctions against Iraq. President Clinton returned to Washington last night facing the near certainty that the House of Representatives will vote to impeach him unless he finds some extraordinary means to reverse the Republican tide running against him. Clinton's almost insurmountable problems became clear yesterday as several previously undeclared Republicans announced they would vote for impeachment on one or more of the four articles of impeachment lodged against the president. The blows to Clinton came one by one throughout the day. It wasn't Republicans considered long shots by the White House who proclaimed their intention to vote against the president. Rather, the White House lost Republicans it believed it had a good chance of winning to prevent Clinton from becoming only the second president to be impeached. The president's planning to meet with Connecticut Republican Christopher Shays of Connecticut, whose anti-impeachment stance has shifted to uncertain, and other undeclared Republicans individually in an effort to find a tough censure option, including a fine and an admission of wrongdoing to keep the last Republicans from defecting. And Georgia Congressmember Bob Barr, as well as Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott and other prominent elected officials, have been closely linked with the Council of Conservative Citizens, the CCC, a, quote, Southern traditionalist organization, which is the successor to the notorious White Citizens Councils, referred to during the Civil Rights era as the Uptown Klan. Barr was the keynote speaker at the Council's National Conference last June and was pictured in the group's newsletter, Citizens Informer, addressing the Council's board and posing with several CCC leaders. The Washington Times and Village Voice have both reported that Senator Lott is a longtime member and supporter of the organization. Barr was in the House Judiciary Committee that voted on the full four articles of impeachment. And if this impeachment vote does go to the Senate, Senator Trent Lott will play a key role in the president's impeachment. The addition of Citizens Informer featuring Congressman Barr's appearance before the CCC also includes a column by the founder of Mississippi's White Citizens Council describing how interracial marriage degrades white civilization. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, President Clinton last night returned from his trip to Israel and the Palestinian territories to face the somber reality of almost certain impeachment by the House of Representatives. All day yesterday, Republican after Republican dashed White House hopes that the undecided group of moderate GOP House members would provide the swing vote against impeachment as they announced that they had decided to vote for the impeachment of the president. Last night, major African-American figures from the entertainment world came together on another issue. It was to celebrate the 50th wedding anniversary of actors and activists Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis, and it was a fundraiser for community theater groups in New York. Among the people who attended were Bill Cosby and Dick Gregory, poet and author Maya Angelou, actor Sidney Poitier, playwright Douglas Turner Ward, and Essence editor-in-chief Susan Taylor. The Reverend Jesse Jackson was also among the guests, and I had a chance to speak with each of them about the issue of impeachment. But before we go to all that, I didn't want to leave Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis's celebration of their 50th anniversary out of it all. And the person who introduced them to the crowd who had come to celebrate their lives was Bill Cosby.
Before you all head up to where you're going, ladies and gentlemen, I just want to let you know what this evening is all about. Before you, can we turn off the Hawaiian music? First of all, in the wheelchair, the only one allowed in the wheelchair tonight is Ozzie Davis' mother. And she's in a wheelchair. It isn't that she can't walk, it's just that she's tired of telling Ozzie to get up on his own and get a job, and that he has worn her out. Being 100 means nothing, and when she gets to the millennium, then she can be something, but 100 is nothing, you know? Yes. Now, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. and Mrs. Davis, they're very, very humble people, Ruby and Ozzie. The big deal is that they're married 50 years, which is not a big deal, because I asked Ozzie, how do you stay married that long? He said, just keep coming home. And I said, Ruby, is that true? She said, yes, I leave the light on for you. And what it is the reason why they are together is because Ozzie's mother left in the will that the last one living will get everything she has. And so Ruby and Ozzie, they'll probably be here for another 1,000 years. And it's all good because the money is in the bank, it's accruing interest, and they'll be able to spend it if they can remember it. It is a benefit, ladies and gentlemen. The different groups, the different theater groups, as you all know, the word culture means broke. And tonight, we're going to raise some money for the broke people so they can give you culture. Ruby and Ozzie are very, very private people. They would not have allowed their names to be put with something where you get a list of your friends, and then they write your friends and ask your friends to send money for them to raise money for this. And so tonight, they allowed themselves to go down to raise money. They have no friends left because it's tiring to get a letter from Ruby and Ozzie, who they haven't given me anything. I didn't get a check from them for anything, and I've asked them for money. My rent was due in 1948. Sidney Poitier and I were living together, at that time. Sidney had just gotten out of the Army. Sidney was in the Army. Huh? Sidney's 2 years older than I am. And, he's older than that? Well, anyway, Ozzy met Ruby. Ruby was 9. This is before pedophiling. There was no internet pedophiling. This is in the South. You could marry people at age 9. And so they had a blood test. He was 6. And nobody cared because they were slaves at the time. And Thomas Jefferson told him, said, go forth and multiply. And so they had a few children. There's a lot of Davises around there. One of the boys named Sammy. And then they named one Miles. And the boys did quite well. People don't know this. This is Black history. And then they did split up, because ordinarily they would be married 55 years. They split up for 5 years, where she got married to Dick Gregory. And they had a child, but they messed the name of Gregory Hines. See, if you look at the thing backwards, it's Hines Gregory. See, that's their child. So all of this, you all have to be careful who you put your daughters with, because there's a whole lot of this going around. Now, I want all of you to go on upstairs and enjoy yourself. Don't fight over things. If you have a ticket and it's for a specific table, go sit at that seat. This is not a football game where, because you want to sit up front and nobody's there, so you sit down and the people show up and you have a fight with them because they weren't there on time. All right? Now, those of you have to understand, this is, even though it's Ruby and Ozzy, and they have been very militant, and they have been out there, there's no collard greens, no bacon, none of that. Don't get mad. You'll see some things you've never seen before. Things wrapped up in things, and they'll say it's that. Eat it and swallow it. Don't spit things out talking about, and how much was this? All right? So we're going to be well-behaved. I want to congratulate all the women. And I feel sorry for you tonight because you know your shoes don't fit. And some of you, 7-step. You got those 7-step shoes on. 7 steps and they come off. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, let's all have a big hand and a big celebration tonight. I'm sorry I cannot be with you, but I have to fly into Washington, D.C. and eat.
Bill Cosby.
Good night.
Speaking last night at the 50th anniversary celebration of actors and activists Ruby Dee and Ozzy Davis. Among the people who were there were many of this country's luminaries, African-American luminaries, particularly in the field of entertainment. And I got a chance to walk around throughout the dinner and the ceremony talking to people about what they thought was happening in Washington. Among those I spoke with was the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Reverend Jackson, a quick comment on what you're doing on Thursday and why you think this is happening in Washington.
The extreme right wing has, in a sense, sought to seize our government. Mr. Clinton's active indiscretion does not qualify as a high crime and misdemeanor, nor a threat to our state this moment.
As Jackson was speaking, Maya Angelou walked up. She was the inaugural poet of 1992, President Clinton's first inauguration, and I asked her what she thought about the impeachment. Jesse Jackson asked her if she'd be coming to Washington Thursday morning for the rally against impeachment that'll take place at Congress. Maya Angelou, what do you think about this possible impeachment?
About impeachment? Of whom?
Of the president.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Will you be at the march on Thursday?
I will be there.
On Thursday, will you be?
I will be in Washington.
Why do you think they're doing it?
Because it's so ridiculous. I just have to be there to see how ridiculous we can be, some of our fellow citizens can be. I will be watching.
Back to Reverend Jackson.
This is a lame duck Congress that is imposing its will on the American people, defying the American will. There'll be five people voting who were defeated by the public on November the 3rd. If the five who were defeated were not voting and the five who won were voting, they would not have the votes. It's the kind of coup d'etat. What we're simply saying is that let there be proportional justice. Mr. Clinton apparently lied about an indiscreet sex act. That's not a high crime, that's a low crime. It's not a crime against the state, nor a threat to national security. And to attempt to lower the bar of impeachment to this level is a sad day for democracy. So on Thursday, from 10 a.m. to 2, we shall gather on the steps of the Capitol and let our voices be heard. We shall protest this attempt to, in fact, undercut the government. The Congress at least wants the right to choose between censorship, impeachment. And using a parliamentary technicality, they will not allow the Congress the choice of impeachment or censorship. They don't want Clinton's apology. They want his head. They want to ram a dagger through his chest. It's beneath the dignity of mature officials.
Why has activism taken so long?
I think because prior to November the 3rd, people were putting their energies into voter registration. On November 3rd, the people turned out. We had the impression that the people had been heard. And then, in a maneuver, Mr. Hyde used the 81 questions as a kind of Trojan horse to let the forces back out again. So I think most people have simply been traumatized, astonished, could not believe that this happened. And so I simply made an appeal this past Friday for people to wake up, because they are attempting to impeach President Clinton and remove him from office. We must gather and now begin to fight back.
Last question, is it true you're going to Libya and Cuba?
At some point in time. I'm certainly going to Cuba fairly soon. But we as a nation, if we can talk with China, if we can expect Netanyahu and Arafat to talk, then we can talk with Castro, and we can talk with Gaddafi. We must have a less talk policy and a big tent policy. And by talking, we change things for the better. So let's talk it out rather than fight it out.
Thank you. That was the Reverend Jesse Jackson speaking last night in New York at a big 50th anniversary celebration of the actors and activists Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis. The master of ceremonies of that event was Susan Taylor. She's editor-in-chief of Essence Magazine, the largest circulation lifestyle magazine for African-American women. And as the event was going on, I asked her what she thought about the possible impeachment of the president.
It saddens me. It saddens me that when we should be attending to the business of the country, feeding hungry people, housing homeless people, creating jobs for those people who are not benefiting from the boom we keep reading about, that we're focused on removing from office a person who has really helped the country to move forward, even though, like the rest of us, he has serious personal flaws. And I just really think it's a shame that we allow this to happen in what we think is the greatest country in the world. We're not so great during this era.
Sidney Poitier also participated in the event, the first African-American actor to receive an Academy Award, a real pioneer in Hollywood. Sidney Poitier, could I get your view on what's happening in Washington right now with the possible impeachment of President Clinton?
I think it's an unfortunate time for us all that such a thing could happen. In America, that the majority of the American people would like to see it concluded in a just and honest and fair way, and that does not seem to get through to the politicians. I hope, probably against hope, that they will have a change of heart.
Thanks very much. Sidney Poitier, first African-American actor to receive an Academy Award. spoke to him, along with Susan Taylor of Essence Magazine, Maya Angelou, and Jesse Jackson about the possible impeachment of the president. When we come back from break, we'll hear from Douglas Turner Ward, the founder of the Negro Ensemble Company, and we'll talk to Dick Gregory, again, all about what's happening in Washington on Thursday, whether or not the president will be impeached. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
I've got a lot of living to do before I die, and I ain't got no time to waste. Let's make it. Do what you gotta do. Come on back, see me when you can. Man, I can understand how it might be kinda hard to love a girl like me. I don't blame you much for wanting to be free. I just wanted you to know I've loved you better than your own kin did. From the very start, it's my own fault what happens to my heart. You see, I've always known you'd go, so you just do what you gotta do, my wild, sweet love.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as we remain at that event last night, a grand event celebrating well-known activists, artists, actors, Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis on their 50th anniversary, their 50th wedding anniversary. Among those who were there to celebrate was Douglas Turner Ward. He is a playwright, a director, and founder of the Negro Ensemble Company. I wasn't there to talk with him about community theater, that was what was being celebrated last night, but about, in some ways, the theater, but also very real-life issue that is being debated right now in Washington.
It looks like President Clinton will be impeached,
as
more and more Republicans talk about voting that way. What are your thoughts on that?
The word has been used, but I think it's clear now that it's meaningful and that it's a coup. I mean, it's really a coup d'etat. Now, I'm not politically necessarily a great fan of Bill Clinton, but from the opposite perspective, I'm more left than he is. But it's obvious in terms of what's happening now that this is this is a coup d'etat, and ignoring basically the election. And I think that the Republicans don't care. I mean, they think that, you know, they can possibly get away with it, or at least lock in their own constituency to their, rightist agenda, basically. But I think it really will be a tremendous blow to what America considers itself in terms of being a democracy, if it happens, because I think it will set a precedent. That even the electorate, which very often is not even given a real democratic chance, but even the votes won't count anymore. I mean, so that really is a dangerous precedent. Anytime any particular clique in power or think it has the power can control what happens in the political, on the political scene by coming up with impeachments or what have you. I think it's a horrible precedent in relation to this country.
It sounds like the majority of people feel this way, and yet it's going forward. While people talk about it, they don't do something about it.
Well, I think now it's become clear that it's now, it's clear that people have to now put some weight behind what the polls have reflected all along. See, everybody's just assumed that, it's in the polls, so that's going to stop them from going ahead, but it's obvious that that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen now unless people actively act on preventing it. And I mean preventing it not so much for, as far as Clinton goes, as from my standpoint, it's just the precedent that it sets, period. And if it can happen to Clinton, who in many ways, ironically, has taken over their agenda. And if they hate him so badly that they want to impeach him when he's already half of his program has been really their program, and then that really is a terrible comment in terms of where they're coming from, because it's not like Clinton is a raging left wing president or anything like that. You know, he's not even a centrist. Basically, his program has been more oriented towards their agenda than it has been towards my agenda, which, as I said, I nakedly say I would prefer a much more left-wing agenda.
Given that, and given his stance, why do you think it is that the African-American community, perhaps more than any other, is his last bastion of support?
If you look at American political history, you will find that the African-American community have always been instinctively right about politics. I mean, nobody gives us credit for the fact that we have instinctively perceived when things were not in our self-interest. This is not just Clinton. I mean, this has been consistent. Look at the voting. I mean, the people that African-Americans have voted against almost unanimously have always been people who we knew were not in our best interest. Whether they won or lost, we knew. And it turned out that we were always right. The rest of the masses and the working class, white masses in particular, only find out after it's too late. And this, so as far as this concerned, we just continuing a smart tradition, and I think it's because of where we place in the society, that we place at a vantage point where we can easily see who's in our best interest and perceive when somebody is out to get us. I mean, even like everybody with the OJ case, for instance. Everybody think it was about black people responding to protect black people. Didn't really like OJ, didn't care about him. But they perceived something else was at stake more than him, and that's why they almost unanimously, whether they thought he did it or not, came to not defend him, but to prevent the utilization of that case against all of us. See, so I mean that's just another instance of what I said, is that where we're placed in the society as maybe the outsider, you want to put it that way, that maybe we can see things clearer than everybody else.
You've been listening to Douglas Turner Ward. Douglas Turner Ward, the founder of the Negro Ensemble Company, playwright and director. Douglas Turner Ward wrote the play Day of Absence, a day when all African Americans vanished from a southern city. This idea later gave rise to Black Solidarity Day, the Monday before Election Day in November. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Douglas Turner Ward and Dick Gregory and many others last night celebrating the 50th anniversary of Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis, the actors and activists. In the last segment of today's show, we're going to hear a speech by Leon Higginbotham. He died 2 days ago at the age of 70, the black jurist well known for his theories of law around civil rights. We'll hear a speech he gave just a few years ago. But now we turn to a more unusual theory about what's happening in Washington, and this is being put forward by Dick Gregory.
Quick question about what's going on right now in Washington and your thoughts, Dick Gregory.
Well, I always thought it was a script. It's not a surprise to me. It'd be a surprise to me if an impeachment happened and if he stays in. I think he's going to resign. I think there's been a deal made, and all they're doing is just orchestrating it. No, I'm not silly enough to believe that a little snotty-nosed white girl is going to threaten the most powerful man in the world and bring it to this. It's always, in my mind, has been a CIA, British intelligence conspiracy. Same thing happened to Harold Wilson with the CIA when they brought Thatcher in. It's the same script being played over again. And, you know, we had, in Washington, D.C., three people was murdered at a Starbucks coffee shop. And no newspaper has printed that the girl Mahoney was Monica Lewinsky's best friend, and it was murdered there. And when the eyewitness said they didn't look like robbers, they looked like hit men, they found him dead 2 days later. This is not what we think it is. And so I've said 4 years ago, I say that now, he won't finish the term out, and not because of impeachment. I think there's a deal made, and he will eventually step down.
What do you think, given your theory, these powers don't like about Bill Clinton. Given your theory, what do you think these powers don't like about Bill Clinton? I mean, you yourself...
It has nothing to do with him. That's what, see, we, ordinary people, is in the same trick the Germans is in with Hitler and the Nazis. They didn't decide today that they was going to make that move. That was well planned and well thought out. Before he went in the White House, this was already planned, and I always felt it was to get Jay Rockefeller in the White House. They almost did it with Nelson when Nixon came out. And they didn't shoot straight in San Francisco, so they figured they have to do it again, but they can't do it in the same party. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Jay Rockefeller is the first time in the history of the Rockefeller family that he's a Democrat, and all of them have been Republican. And I think that's what we're fixing to see played out.
What happens then in your scenario? You have Clinton resigning, and then what?
Then you have Gore in, and then they dirty up Gore. And then we do the same thing when Nixon resigned. Ford went in, and then he picked Nelson. I mean, think about Gerald Ford picking Nelson Rockefeller. What do they have in common? And you're going to see the same thing happen again in my scenario. And
you're saying Gore will choose Jay Rockefeller?
Yeah, Gore will choose Rockefeller. The script's already there.
This is a novel theory.
Huh?
This is a novel theory. I haven't heard it before.
Yeah, well, I've been saying it for years. There's that whole committee of 300. It got nothing to do with left wing and right wing. Queen Elizabeth, she left for right. The super rich people on the planet, they don't play that left and right. That's for working folks that want to sit around, drink beer, and eat pretzels. The real people that run this game is folks that ripped off the savings and loan, and every American is paying to the tune something like $20 a month to the year 2030, and we don't care because we have no power over it.
Do you care about what's happening?
I care about what's happening. That's why I keep talking out and keep talking out, because eventually truth is going to win. It won in Nazi Germany, but look at the Holocaust that it created.
The majority of Americans are against impeachment, but it's rolling forward anyway. But most people are not doing something about it. They'll answer when polled, but they're not doing anything about it.
Who takes the poll? If I want Clinton to be 100%, I go to Ghetto and take it. If I want him to be 100% negative, I go in the suburbs and take it. Until you tell me who the poll is. If I go out to the airport and interview people and say, who you think is the most important to the airline? And if everybody says SkyCap, if you don't know that's all I was interviewing, then you don't understand that poll.
But do you think that most people are against impeachment?
No, most can be led to be against anything they want to be led against. Anything. You're looking at people accept behavior off of this man they wouldn't accept off their own children. Why? Because they've been told by NBC and CBS and ABC. It didn't happen. It happened before. Hitler and the Nazis ran the Germans through the same thing. And then everybody assumes. I mean, you got black folk running around believe we did something in that last election. What did we do? The only senator that was black got lost. We didn't put enough Congress people in to give those black Democrats real power. And we think we had some power. We flexed our muscles the same way we did in slavery. Just long enough to pick the cotton and it was over.
So what's your overriding emotion today as we move into Thursday's impeachment?
I don't have none. It's a game. It's a script. It's a script. They just write it and it plays it out. And you see it, and then it will never get to the extent where it's going to go to impeachment. He'll step down, he'll resign, or they'll assassinate him. They play mean. They play dirty.
Do you think President Clinton represents the issues that you care about? In the way that you care about.
We keep trying to mix things. It has nothing to do with that. It has nothing to do with that at all. You know, how do you put a welfare mother's bill through when you got 600,000 to 800,000 welfare mothers that's drug addicts or alcoholics, and there's no provision in there for that? I wouldn't hire you if you had 20 doctor's degrees from Yale if you was a drug addict, so who's going to hire them? That's 600,000. So that's the problem that I have.
So you're saying you don't support what Clinton has done?
I never have. You know, and what America ends up with is the lesser of the evils. You know.
Given that you don't think that Clinton represents what's good for America, what are your thoughts about the, well, and you're saying you have to question the polls, but that the overwhelming sentiment of the black community is for Clinton, perhaps the strongest bastion of support right now?
Yeah, but that's because, you know, he's always talked to those black folks. And so, you know, what is it to get strength from me when nobody else is paying attention? He wins by default. That's just how simple that is. Remember, we was Republicans because of Abraham Lincoln, 99%. And then we turned Democrat because of Roosevelt. Whoever talks to me and address my issues more than somebody else gets my attention.
Do you agree with Toni Morrison that he is, that she wrote in The New Yorker, the black president?
No, not at all.
You have people like the strongest people for President Clinton, for his defense, are black Congress members, Maxine Waters, Sheila Jackson Lee.
But would it be for him if he was Republican and they was Republican? You know, you're bringing me a politics now. You know. And you got women that would like not to be for him, but he's the best they got. And so, you know, we talk about the black movement. What about the women's movement, which is basically white? They're tripping over their heels over and they're embarrassed. At least we're not embarrassed about it.
Do you think he's failed America?
No, not necessarily. First, we assume that America was in, you know, it's the same thing we're talking about family values. When did we ever have it? We've never had family values. When we beat up the Indians, do we have family values? Stole black folk, we have family values. When a white woman came on the boat with him, didn't get the right to vote till 1920, was that family values? When a Jew had to change their last name and their nose to walk down the street safe, when Asians had to come out only at nighttime, when two Italians, just because their name was Psycho and Vanzetti, went to the electric chair, when did we ever have family values? We closer to family values today than ever before in the history of America. It has nothing to do with him. It has something to do with a lot of beautiful folks that's out here that committed with their life to make a change. They will never make the New York Times or the Washington Post, and they don't care. So a bunch of people that don't have to be validated by nobody but a universal truth. That's what's going to win, and that's what makes this country bearable.
Have you read the reports about Georgia Congressmember Bob Barr, as well as Trent Lott, the Senate Majority Leader, and their connections to what are the modern-day citizens' councils, white citizens' councils of the South?
Yeah, when you look at Bob Barr, the first time he ran for Congress, he had to step down because they was accusing him of being a Negro. When you read all the reports, and the next time you look at him, look at his nose and his lips.
So what are you saying?
I'm not saying nothing. I'm saying, had I read the report, I said, have you read all the reports? You know, it depends on what report you read and where you stop.
But what about, do you have a response to their giving addresses to and working with these white supremacist groups in the South?
No, you know, I'm just glad that it's out, but it don't surprise. I don't think it surprised nobody in the black community, you know.
Do you think we're at a low point in American politics, or is it all the same all these years?
All the same. We're at the low point because we're in an information age. They're doing less dirt now than ever. Harry Truman used to walk down the street on his morning press conference every morning, and when it asked about the Negro problem, he referred to it as nigger. The press just didn't report it. He never referred to Negroes as Negro. He said nigger. And the press never reported it. He couldn't get by with that now. So politics haven't changed. The news media have changed. And that's not, they haven't changed that much, because the New York Times and NBC and CBS, they still are that rolling, that controlling group, and they're going to print what they want to print. But there's just certain things that just press people wouldn't tolerate now.
Given your theory that it's a CIA conspiracy, why does the CIA want Clinton out?
The CIA has nothing to do with it. The CIA works for people. The CIA don't run nothing on their own. The CIA don't bring drugs on this country because they want to drug. They work for that handful of elite, leech, rich aristocrats that rule and control the whole world.
You want to name some names?
The Rockefellers, the DuPonts, the Mellons, you know, it's 300 elite families around the world. And they didn't just happen, they've been in charge. And if we're stupid enough to look at the Fortune 500, none of them name is listed. You tell me, I'm going to look at 500 rich people in the world and Rockefeller's not listed? DuPont's not listed? Mellon's not listed? That's a comedy. That's a comedy.
Comedian Dick Gregory offering his commentary on what's happening in Washington. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. In our next segment, we're going to hear a speech given by Leon Higginbotham, the retired Chief Judge Emeritus of the United States Court of Appeals, who died earlier this week. Also, we'd like to hear from you. What are you doing about the possible impeachment of the president? However you feel about it, are you taking action or are you just sitting back? We'd like to know. The number to call and leave a comment is 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. Again, tomorrow in Washington, D.C., there'll be a major rally outside Congress. Jesse Jackson, John Sweeney, president of the AFL-CIO, Maya Angelou, and many others will be there. What are you doing in your community, either for or against impeachment? 212-209-2999 is the number to call and let us know. Those people who you've heard speaking for the last two segments were at the 50th anniversary celebration of activists, artists, actors, Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
There's a light, a certain kind of light.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. He was lauded as the voice of the poor, the powerless, and the downtrodden, a champion for civil rights. He was also one of the country's most prominent and influential black judges. A. Leon Higginbotham, former Chief Judge of the 3rd U.S. District Court of Appeals and recipient of the Presidential Medal of Honor. He died this Monday in Boston. Just 2 weeks ago, Judge Higginbotham addressed the House Judiciary Committee and urged its members not to impeach President Clinton. As a legal scholar, Higginbotham championed affirmative action, and some of his most impassioned opinions dealt with social and racial issues. In one nationally noted opinion, he ruled in 1987 that local governments must pay for abortions for prisoners who are not covered by other public aid. After retiring from the bench, Higginbotham became more and more disillusioned with the state of civil rights in the United States and warned of the dangers of turning back the clock of racial progress. Some historians say Judge Higginbotham was one of a handful of black jurists President Lyndon Johnson considered as candidates to integrate the Supreme Court before he named Thurgood Marshall the first black justice in 1967. In an article he wrote for the New York Times Magazine this past January, entitled Breaking Thurgood Marshall's Promise, Judge Higginbotham talked about how the dismantling of affirmative action programs by some of the nation's law schools had dramatically shrunk enrollment of minority students. He said, quote, "Embedded in these cold facts is a personal story of how 47 years ago I witnessed the birth of racial justice in the Supreme Court, and now, after 45 years as a lawyer, judge, and law professor, I sometimes feel as if I am watching justice die." Well, in 1996, Judge Higginbotham gave a graduation speech at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. He had given more than 60 such speeches over his career. This is an excerpt of that speech.
"But it was not until my daughter's graduation that I was able to appreciate the extraordinary emotional impact of my own graduation from Yale Law School on my mother. I still remember how she embraced me with tears in her eyes. And I still remember how my father stood back trembling with emotion. My mother had washed thousands of other people's dishes and scrubbed hundreds of other people's floors to make that day possible for her only son. My father had worked as a laborer in the same factory for 45 years, late only once in that entire period of time when there was a blizzard. And yet he never got a promotion on his job, even though it was acknowledged that he was far more competent than the many immigrants he had trained at the factory. He taught them how to read English, how to follow the instructions on labels, and years later they would become his foremen, and sometimes would speak derogatorily of his race, even though he played a critical role in helping them to become upward mobile. And I now recognize that the diploma which Yale gave me should not have been issued only to me, but on that diploma there should have been the name of Emma Lee Higginbotham. And on that diploma there should have been the name of A.L. Higginbotham, Sr. And as you come up here and receive your diplomas, and as you have them on the walls, I hope that you will always have the vision to recognize those who helped make it possible and how profoundly fortunate you are, because some of the names which could be added to your diploma were individuals who never had the door of opportunity cracked for them. And during this moment of exhilaration, I will not give you the advice of which my good friend Nell Painter gave. I will make two different requests of you. And they are that you always attempt to see those human beings who have become invisible to most people. And that you always try to hear the pleas of those persons who, despite their pain and suffering, have become voiceless and forgotten in our nation and our world. Most of you will become part of the affluent generation during the 21st century. You will dwell in pleasant suburbia or in other comfortable settings in our cities. And despite the fact that millions of homeless cannot find a job, you will pursue careers whereby your median income will be far above the nation's average. Your children will in all probability have adequate medical care. Your parents will get a respectable burial. And in summary, you will fully exploit the privileges of our great nation as elite beneficiaries of the opportunities here. The fundamental question is whether you will become oblivious or refuse to care about the misery that millions of other Americans still endure unnecessarily in our nation. In 1947, Ralph Ellison pierced the veil of those who would ignore the less fortunate in his magnificent book. He described the irony of invisibility and non-caring. He said, "I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me." And though Ellison was describing the particular plight of blacks in a society riddled with racial bias, his concept of the invisible person transcends racial, gender, religious, ethnic, and national barriers. And fundamentally, it was a description of the plight of vast numbers of people as human and as real as anyone else, but who are reduced to non-existence, to invisibility, not through their own actions, but often through the insensitivity of those around them. In many ways, those victims are neither seen, nor heard, nor cared about. And thus, during your moment of glory and vindication today, my fervent request is that you never allow yourself to become blinded to the injustices around you, that you never become callous and sensitive men and women, that you never look upon other people around you as if they are invisible objects, as if they do not suffer, as if they do not bleed, as if they do not have human aspirations, and as if they do not have dreams, and as if they do not need our society's help, and as if they do not need your help. I pray that you will not be cynical, that you will have the courage to dream of a better world, and to thereafter work to make at least some portion of that dream a reality in the lives of others. I trust that you will become as interested in the human welfare and the human dignity of all our citizens as you will be concerned about the capital gains tax benefits that aid primarily the affluent. I trust that you will never sign on to any contract with America that sanctions or promotes exclusions. I trust that you will never sign on any contract of America that puts the weak, the poor, women, minorities, and persons of color in a disadvantaged position. And I trust you will understand what Dr. Martin Luther King meant when he said, "I have the audacity to believe that people everywhere can have three meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, and dignity, equality, and freedom for their spirits." And thus the question is, will you in your life contribute to and associate with people and institutions that believe in Dr. King's message? And will you seek to aid the weak, the sick, and the powerless? Or will you be signatories to a proposed contract with America that withdraws federal entitlements from poor children? And while it is easy to deplore the tragic conditions in Bosnia, Rwanda, the greater test of our character is not what we condemn abroad, but what we do at home. And here we can make a far greater difference. As you celebrate the joy of your graduation, each of you should ask yourselves, would I be here today if I had been born and lived all of my life in a public housing project or in rural poverty? You should ask yourself, what would be my present status? Would I be here today if I had been like one of the 10 million children today who have never had health insurance? And would I be here today if I had not had the privileges which I got by matter of coincidence? And as one sits here and looks at this beautiful campus that has been your home for at least 4 years, reflect a bit on the fact that as you have flourished in this elegant, magnificent environment, 1 in 4 children, or nearly 16 million, live below the poverty line. 1 in 4 homeless persons will be a child under the age of 18. And whatever may be your religious views, hopefully you can find some meaning in the 59th chapter of Isaiah, where it is written, "If you do away with the yoke of oppression, with the pointing finger and malicious tongue, and if you spend yourselves in behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed, then your light will rise in the darkness and your night will become like the noonday. The Lord will guide you always. He will satisfy your needs in a sun-scorched land and will strengthen your frame. You will be like a well-watered garden, like a spring whose waters never fail. Your people will rebuild the ancient ruins and will raise up the age-old foundations. You will be called the repairer of broken walls, restorer of streets with dwellings." And thus, for you, the class of 1996, do you intend to be a rebuilder of the ruins of our American city? Do you intend to be a repairer of the broken walls of despair and hopelessness? Will you rise up and restore the dialogue that stresses our commonality and builds better bridges of communication across polarizing racial, gender, religious, and ethnic lines. And I do not want to leave you with a mood of depression, for at its worst, I still keep a sense of optimism. As you leave Wesleyan, you enter a world that is better than the world of my college generation, or that of any other generation prior to today. Hitler and Hirohito have been defeated. The Vietnam War ultimately terminated. The Berlin Wall is down. Nelson Mandela is now president of South Africa. And think of these victories before you throw in the sponge because you're dissatisfied with the things which have not been done well. Despite much of the persistent suffering that you must always keep visible, and despite much of the pain that you must always feel as a caring individual for others, never forget that in this country, if we wish, we have the capacity to make ourselves a greater nation, a more caring and fairer nation than we have ever been before. On the other hand, if we put blinders on to the plight of others, we can easily become more greedy, more mean, and more venal than we have in years. The choice is ours. If we keep our visibility and hearing intact as to the real problems in America, we will not let politicians put greed above caring, and we will be able to implement significant portions of the vision about which Langston Hughes spoke when he wrote Dream of Freedom. He said, there's a dream in the land with its back against the wall. By muddled names and strange, sometimes the dream is called. There are those who claim this dream for theirs alone, a sin for which we know they must atone. Unless shared in common, like sunlight and like air, the dream will die for lack of substance anywhere. The dream knows no frontier or tongue. The dream, no class or race. The dream cannot be kept secure in any one locked place. This dream today embattled, with its back against the wall, to save the dream for one, it must be saved for all.
That was Judge A. Leon Higginbotham, retired Chief Judge Emeritus of the United States Court of Appeals, Public Service Professor of Jurisprudence at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, author of the book Shades of Freedom, died Monday in Boston, speaking at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, at the 1996 commencement. If you'd like a copy of today's program, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Special thanks to Mimi Rosenberg, Ken Nash, and David Sears. Michelle Garcia is our web spinner. Julie Drizin's our executive producer. We'd like to hear from you. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. We're headed down to Washington for Congress's debate on impeachment. We'll be broadcasting from there tomorrow. Today, from the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!